There's a great Indian mystic who, in trying to speak about the sacred, once said, God is closer to you than the ocean is to the fish.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm your host, Dave Plisky. And unfortunately, today we were not able to be joined by my usual co-host, John Gripowicz. But man, do we have an episode in store for you today. I got to have such a wonderful conversation. This marks our second episode in our Islam arc, if you will. In the last episode, we heard from Dalia Mogahed about the Muslim experience in America. And today we get to hear from a Muslim Sufi, which is the mystical tradition of Islam. Just a quick note that toward the end of the episode, it gets a bit heavy as Omid speaks about violence in the Middle East. So if you are a listener who is sensitive to heavier topics or are listening to your family, this might be one to skip or at least skip the end of. Today, we are joined by Omid Safi. Omid is a teacher in the Sufi tradition of radical love and founder of Illuminated Courses and Tours. He is currently a professor at Duke University, specializing in Islamic spirituality and contemporary thought. Omid is committed to the intersection of spirituality and social justice. Omid has published extensively on the foundational sources of Islam and Sufism. His most recent book is Radical Love, Teachings from the Islamic Mystical Tradition. He teaches online courses on Islam and Sufism through Illuminated Courses. His Illuminated Tours have taken more than 2,500 friends from over 20 countries to Turkey and Morocco since 2002. Omid, it's so great to have you. Please, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored and delighted to be with you and with your listeners.
Great. So where we really usually like to start is just to hear about you, you know, your upbringing, your spiritual journey, you know, just kind of what that was like in your life. And, yeah. You know, please feel free to start as far back as you like and tell us as much as you like.
Well, in the beginning, there was just pure divine and there was nothing else that was manifest. And, you know, there's a great Muslim mystic, from the 13th century who says, in the beginning there was God and there was no one with God. In the end there will be God and there will be no one with God. And it is now as it has ever been. I mean, from one point of view, there's really only the divine. And then of course, you know, I am and you are and our listeners are and, you know, the trees and the butterflies are as well. But there is always that reminder that from a divine point of view, there's just absolute divinity. And we're not all that important, you know, yeah. not the center of the world that the ego would like for us to be.
As you said that, I was reminded of what a priest says when he signs us with the ashes on Ash Wednesday, from dust you came and from into dust you shall return. You
know, absolutely. But. Absolutely. And, you know, this is maybe moving a little bit away from the traditional biography account. But in the Muslim tradition, you know, whenever you hear the account that somebody has passed away, usually people say this pietistic phrase, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. We have come from God, and we are always in the process of returning to God. And, you know, the only thing that makes the mystics of Islam a little different than your run-of-the-mill ordinary Muslims is that ordinary Muslims are aware of that statement, particularly at moments of death. Whereas for the mystics, I think there's an awareness that in every breath, we are journeying to God. That creation is really a journey from God to God, and if it can be allowed, in God. There is no outside.
Yeah, I totally agree. And yet it's How difficult is it to be living that moment to moment, breath by breath, right? I mean, it's absolutely. I hope that my consciousness is becoming more and more aware of that reality. And that's actually kind of what the point of this podcast is all about. That we're trying to, allow religion to be so pervasive in our life that it's not that to live an integrated life doesn't. We're no longer thinking about what is our religious self or our faith practices and what is the rest of us. That there shouldn't be a delineation, right? If we're actually living these kind of fully integrated lives in God.
Yeah, and I think, in some ways, this is part of the oppressive nature of so much of modern society, particularly in a capitalistic turn, which wants to compartmentalize religion to
Exactly.
something that you do, Sundays between 10 and noon, maybe for 5 minutes, hands folded, in your bedroom, Friday for Muslims, Saturday for Jews, and all of that. Whereas the whole of being is actually sacred. And there's a great Indian mystic who, in trying to speak about the sacred, once said, God is closer to you than the ocean is to the fish. And the fish, if you want to stretch your imagination a little bit, the fish, whatever language they speak, they probably don't have a word for ocean because they're in it. And now, with a fish, they could be fished out of the sea or the ocean. And of course, that's when they meet their end, or at least they continue in a different form. How are we going to be taken out of divine presence? Where in being, where in creation could we go that is outside of God? And if such a thing were to be allowed outside of God, well, that would mean a limited God. That would mean a God who has borders and boundaries. And who wants a puny God? Who wants a tiny, bounded up God,
And
right?
forget what you want. If that's what you think God is, then you must not really be very close to naming him, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, but in terms of giving a more conventional answer, which is sometimes much less interesting, each of us, our biographies are the lives that we have known and we have lived. And so it's only to other people that sometimes they seem interesting or unusual. So in some ways, I'm kind of a reverse or double immigrant. I was born in Florida, but raised in Iran. And I count myself very, very fortunate that my entire childhood and formative years as a young adult were spent in Iran, that I got to know that diverse society of Muslims, Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, quite intimately, not through books, but through lived experience. And then I migrated back to the US as a US citizen who didn't speak English when I was 15. And in some ways, when it comes to spiritual matters, I think I've been quite fortunate in the sense that my encounter with the Christian tradition, the Jewish tradition, the Buddhist tradition, it's really come out of approaching the best and the deepest and the most expansive, most generous, most loving versions of each one of those traditions. Rather than having, television headlines or something shape my understanding and imagination. So, you know, when I think about the Jewish tradition, it's largely shaped through the lens of Rabbi Heschel.
Oh, nice.
And I was blessed enough in my life to have been loved on and mentored by the late Vincent Harding, Uncle Vincent, close friend of Dr. King's. And so really, when I think about the Christian tradition, it's in the light of this, you know, Black-led freedom movement, this liberationist tradition. I don't tend to think in terms of, you know, people standing on a street corner and telling you that you're going to hail. So, you know, in some ways, I've always found that to be a beautiful way for us as God's children to get to know one another, that if we're curious about a religious tradition, we should get to encounter its truest, its deepest, its highest, its most saintly variety.
Yeah, that's and what, yeah, you're very right about being how fortunate you are spiritually to have
Absolutely.
Those influences from those other traditions.
Yeah.
Also, you seem to be very fortunate linguistically, because you said that you moved back to the States at 15. And I think developmentally, they say that people will tend to hold on to their accent after, I think that the age is 11, something happens like after 11, where it's like really hard to get rid of the previous accent, but you don't seem to have it. So that's impressive to me.
Yeah, it's I just look at it as, you know, God has a plan for everybody's life, and I couldn't have chosen a life journey where I would have gotten to live long enough in Iran to have absorbed the rich ambiance. It's one of the, you know, most ancient civilizations in the world, has a beautiful tradition of a mystical and poetic understanding of Islam. And yet, you know, moved to the U.S. at a time where I could be acculturated here, and to whatever measure, you know, pick up a level of fluency, so that I can be a teacher and a bridge maker.
That's beautiful. But so the one thing I'm still curious about in your story is, did you, so you, you know, you kind of mentioned the difference between, you know, Sufis and kind of, I think you used the term run of the mill Muslims, which I don't mean anything bad by, but
sure, of course.
Is that the tradition you grew up in, or were you always aware of and being, I mean, maybe your family are Sufis. I just, you know, how did that happen?
Yeah, you know, it's these days we're all so consumed by names and labels, which, you know, also lend themselves to kind of a narrow sense of identities, and even, you know, for some of us, and I'm not in any way, you know, above or beyond this, but we're trying to get our name out there and have a podcast and have a course and have a retreat. And so, you know, what's the label? Or to use language that I'm patently uncomfortable with, what's your brand? You know? And that's all kind of really interesting, because at least in a mystical tradition, there's always the notion that, I mean, the word mystic and mystical, mysticism, these all come from mysteries. That the greatest mystery about the human is perhaps something that is unspoken, and at some level, even unspeakable. And so what we get in our tradition is that word Sufi, or the mystics of the Islamic tradition, it's a little bit trying to speak about lovers and dreamers, seekers, those who yearn not for heaven, but they yearn for the very heart of God. And if you were to walk in a room, would you immediately know how many people are lovers? Well, you know, some people might have a special glow about them, or a kind of faraway look in their eyes. They might smile for no reason at all, and you might guess that there's something there. But many of the greatest mystics of Islam are actually quite ordinary appearing people. And that has always been the case, that the line between the everyday and the saintly is a very, very fluid one in this tradition. So the vast majority of the people that I grew up with may not even have heard of the word Sufi. But if you were to ask them, what are the teachings and the stories and the saintly beings who have shaped your life, virtually every single person that they would name would be someone from the Sufi tradition.
I see. Yeah. It's a Catholic theologian, Bernard Lonergan, who says, there's really two types of people in the world, those who need certainty and those who seek understanding. And I think
Beautiful.
it's kind of what you're talking
That's beautiful. Yeah.
about. Yeah. I don't want to, keep dwelling on the labels, but do you find so? So you said that those who you grew up with would resonate with your approach to Islam,
Absolutely.
but are there those who don't? I mean, do you find acceptance difficult among other Muslims at times?
I think I, being somebody who is steeped in the prophetic tradition, I read the words of Jesus as a prophet is always without honor in his own home. And I read the words of Rabbi Heschel as the task of a prophet is to speak the truth, even if your voice is shaking. I listen to the teachings of Martin, where he talks about, that those who are called by God do something not because it's convenient or popular, because it's right. And it's not to say that one would compare one's own experiences with them, but surely we can learn something from them. I think when I was younger, I was probably a little bit more interested in persuading people that this kind of a love-drenched, justice-inclined approach is so clearly the right one that they should also have some. And I think the older I get, and I'm definitely closer to the end of this earthly life than I am to the beginning, the less interested I am in arguing with people about it. And I think what you want to do is you want to become a living example of what you aspire to and let that be its own testimony.
Is that the goal of Sufism, or is that your own personal goal?
No, I think that's the goal. That's really the goal. There's a wonderful story from the great, great Muslim mystic Rumi, and Rumi might just be the most well-known of all the Muslim mystics and poets. And when he speaks about prayer, he says at one point, "I prayed so often that my whole being has become a prayer. Now, whenever somebody sees my face, they start to pray." And of course, he doesn't mean that they start to pray to him, but he means that he's not teaching about prayer anymore, that the way that he conducts himself is itself worship. And when people are in the presence of someone like that, they want to have some of that. It's I'm old enough that maybe this will resonate with some of your listeners. It's like that scene from the When Harry Met Sally movie, where it's like, I'll have what she's having, right? And that's kind of what it is to really be in the presence of some of these mystics is, I want to have that love. I want to have that serenity. I want to have that sense of groundedness and aspiring for the embrace of the beloved.
There's a verse in 1 Thessalonians about prayer without ceasing, and
Yes.
I think that's what that's referring to.
Absolutely.
And I based on his words, I believe Rumi was there. Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which makes me wonder, obviously all of our goal would be to live that way, live so mindfully, that we're exuding this sort of divine presence on our face, right? What a wonderful way to say that.
Yeah.
But recognizing that maybe we're not all there all the time,
Sure.
do you have particular practices that you could tell us about
So
that are part of your tradition?
yeah, so we do. And for us, one of the main starting points of that is it's a practice of the remembrance of God. And it's a series of litanies that begins with the chanting of a certain mantra, a certain mantric prayer. And it begins with La ilaha illallah. Nothing is worthy of worship except for the one God. And so that's really the moment of Jesus kicking over the tables of the money changers at the temple, or the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them both, removing the idols from the temple that Abraham built. And it's an opportunity for each one of us to think about what is it that we have set up in the temple of God, power, status, greed, clicks, viewership, all of that. And so, first, you have to sweep the temple. You have to create that opening that the Spirit of God can come rushing into. And then there's a phrase, Illallah, only God, only God. And then there's a move that the phrases get more and more compact, abbreviated, taken to the core. Allah, Allah. Oh, you're just chanting the name of God. And, by the way, in the Aramaic language that Christ would have spoken, his word for God, also being a Semitic word, would have sounded quite similar to this Arabic word Allah. And then you end by simply silently observing the breath. And you remember that in all of our teachings, the words for spirit and breath are linked. And so when we are breathing, we are actually not breathing. It's God who's breathing us. That in every moment, there's that divine breath, that Nafas ar-Rahman, that is suffusing us, inspiriting us. And so, how beautiful is it to actually experience yourself being breathed, inhaled, and exhaled by God? So, that's our main spiritual practice that, we do. Typically in the morning times.
Early on in the episode, you were talking about the kind of dissolution of the ego into the divine, and that we're it's not a matter of just recognizing that next step at someone's death, but actually living our lives all the way there. And I'm reminded of Saint Catherine of Siena's quote, all the way to heaven is heaven. And the practices that you're talking about right now, maybe in a technical way, maybe there would be some disagreement between whether the ego should be totally dissolved or not. You know, I think a Christian would say, like, you know, the individuality persists even in the unification of in heaven.
Sure.
But at the core, the idea is the same. I think the humility of Christ and the dissolution of the ego that you're talking about, and even the idea of non-self in Buddhism, I think are all kind of getting at that same idea, right? That this is,
yeah,
it's
I think
God
that's,
working in us. Even the idea of grace is there, right?
I think that's right. And, you know, of course, when we're speaking about such mysteries, this is where human language is pushed to its limits and then some. I mean, think about the ways in which your partner might always remain a great mystery to you, and or, you know, what was going through the mind of a toddler.
Yes.
And
Great
if that's
relate
the
to both
case,
of those things.
exactly. And so if that's the case for us mere humans, how much more about the heart of God, who is both, you know, revealed and also in some ways veiled. And so there are some Sufis who've used metaphors like, you know, the dissolving away of the ego in absolute divinity. There are some who've used and preferred metaphors like it's like the return of the river to the ocean. That there's always just been water, but sometimes we call it river, sometimes we call it ocean. And then there's also some who probably come closer to that notion of individuation that you spoke of. So this is, for example, Rumi's metaphor. It's a cooking metaphor. He says, the goal of the spiritual path is to really cook or ripen your soul. Not to throw it away, not to dissolve it away, but if you were cooking a steak, you would prefer for it to be cooked. And so the goal is to cook away the egoic aspect of our being, the parts of us that wishes to seat itself on the throne of God. And in the same way that fruit ripens and sweetens and softens, and that should be our relationship with the divine.
I've heard you talk about the small self, actually you made the bold claim that I agree with, that there really is no such thing as conflict between religions, that it comes down to individuals who are acting out of greed or some other kind of selfishness. Can you say more about that?
So, you know, there's if you were to say what is the most powerful moment in the life of Christ, and of course there's so many, one could argue that the crucifixion and the resurrection. It would be hard to speak about the significance of Christ without addressing that. If you were to talk about the most powerful moments in the life of the Buddha, well, you know, he was an Indian prince who saw suffering, sat under a tree, and vowed not to get up until he was enlightened. And that enlightenment is when he becomes the Buddha, the awakened one. Then you ask people, what's the most powerful moment in the prophet's life, in Muhammad's life, peace be upon them all? The most powerful moment is, you know, this experience where he's taken on an ascension and he goes from Mecca to Jerusalem and from Jerusalem through the levels of heaven to come to have this face-to-face encounter with God. And that's really the model of what we long for, what we aspire for. We're all going to see the face of God in the world to come. The mystics of Islam are just a little bit more impatient. They want it here and now as well. And what does that all have to do with, in some ways, the unity of religions? It's part of our creed. It's part of our belief that when the prophet is taken on this night journey and he comes to Jerusalem, he is greeted there by all the prophets and all the angels who have ever been and shall forever be. And what do they do together? Do they sit around going, I have a billion followers, you have 2 billion followers? No, they pray together. They line up in prayer towards the one together. And so for us, in a fundamental sense, the goal is not to deny or minimize the particularity of different religious traditions. You know, I sometimes tell people to do that would be like taking pizza and sushi and Indian food and putting it in a blender. What makes each of them delicious is actually its own particularity. But there's also the notion that water is water. It's just over here we call it the Atlantic Ocean, and over there we call it the Pacific Ocean, but it's water. Rumi says at one point, you know, light is light is light. And even if light is coming to you through 1,000 lamps, there's still only one light. And that's how we tend to look at the idea of religious guidance, that there's one absolute divinity, one humanity, and there's a oneness of divine guidance. So, this part of it, interestingly enough, is actually not a mystical idea in Islam. This is as mainstream and Quranic based as it gets. The Quran might be one of the only revelations that has a fairly well developed theology of pluralism, where we're told that to every block of humanity, God has sent a prophet. And some of them we're told again in the Quran. Some of them are named, and many of them are unnamed. There's a certain measure of expansiveness, of openness, that is a part of the Islamic tradition, is that when you come across a religious tradition that's new to you, let's say Taoism, for example, you know, rather than feeling like, oh, I have to reject it because I don't know if I can biblically, Quranically account for it, you ask the question, is it a faith that somehow is calling people to God? Does it offer a moral, ethical way of moving through this world? Does it have some notion in however language or symbols it uses? To talk about accountability for our actions. And if the answers to those are yes, then Muslims historically have had no problem saying, yeah, we recognize that your path too begins with a divine origin.
We're talking with Taoists this season as well, for that very reason, and many others. You mentioned Zoroastrianism. I think that's one of the only religions I did not make an effort to try to get on, although maybe there's still time. But at least major religions. I think that's all right. I mean, actually, the Catholic Church finally has come around to this in Vatican II with the document Nostra Aetate,
That's
saying, look,
right.
whatever is right and good in any faith tradition, we can find wisdom in any of these places. And so it's nice to see the institutional church catching up to what the mystics have always known, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think those kind of moves, they're quite profound and significant. Many of us were moved to see Pope Leo visiting the Sultan Ahmed Mosque, the so-called Blue Mosque in Istanbul, and taking off his shoes. I mean, those are powerful gestures that mean a lot and convey a lot to people. And we certainly live in an age of bombast and vitriol, but that doesn't have to be our only way.
Right.
So to see, the most important of our religious leaders say that we don't have to live in fear of one another.
Right.
It doesn't mean that we have to necessarily come to the same conclusion about everything. Again, food is one metaphor, music is another metaphor, language is another metaphor. And we're allowed to speak different languages.
Absolutely.
And, just as for me to share in the English language with you doesn't take anything away from how tenderly I was able to communicate in Persian with my parents yesterday. And for me to see God's love demonstrated and embodied through the message and the teachings of Christ, for me, it takes nothing away from the beauty, the wisdom, the relevance of the insights of the Buddha or of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, so during this season, I've also been happy. I've been reading a book by Tom Holland called Dominion, where he's talking about the history of Christianity, and really the point that he's making is that even the things from the West that don't seem Christian in nature actually are. They could have only come out of a kind of a Christian culture. But one of the other that's not really where I want to go with this. One of the points that he makes that I never realized is that Indians never viewed Hinduism as a religion because it was just ubiquitous, right? It was a Western Christian idea that we need a label for this thing that they're doing, that and we're going to call it Hinduism and all that kind of stuff. And I think similarly in China, like the ideas of Taoism and Confucianism and Buddhism, at least at a certain point in the history, have just become so infused in kind of the wisdom of a Chinese person that it largely, unless someone is deep into that a particular faith tradition, they largely are just, kind of accessing this stuff without really even maybe being aware of which stream it's coming from. Because it's just kind of pervasive in life.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I mean, it's interesting. The part of the colonial process whereby the English came to dominate India was this need or desire to classify. And they knew what Christianity was, or they thought they did. They knew what they thought Islam was, or they thought they did, Judaism perhaps, and then pretty much everything else they bracketed together as the Hindu traditions. And in typical colonial obsession with classification, they made people do a census where they had to check off what religion they followed, and it was a multiple choice. And the largest number of people chose two. I am a Hindu Musalman. I'm a Hindu Muslim. And they were like, what do you do? You can't. No, you cannot. You have to choose one, And so I think those are kind of instructive moments. And of course, within each of our religious traditions, not only is there extraordinary diversity, but there have also been moments of clash and conflict. We know this, that the Latin Crusades took out just as much violence against Eastern Christians as they did against Muslims. And we have had versions of that within the Islamic tradition as well, of different juridical or sectarian conflicts, kind of as well. So I think part of it is, the world is certainly not divided, and it's not a monopoly game. But
No, it's not a zero-sum game.
it's not a zero-sum game, and particularly where we live in an age where you could really characterize this age as, It's an age of truly evil men in positions of power. And it's not one or two countries, and it's certainly not one or two nations. But you can look at our own country, you can look at Russia, you can look at India, you can look at Israel, you can look at lots of different places. So the question is, what do we have to offer?
Yeah.
What do we have to offer in terms of a way of coexistence that is more harmonious with the will of God?
People from these different faith traditions who are carrying out violence, sometimes in the name of the tradition, sometimes in the name of their government, they can often point to their tradition's scriptures and say, "Look, I'm this is scriptural, right? Like the divine has blessed violence. Just look at this, this verse here."
Yeah.
And that's possible in all of these traditions.
Of course.
And similarly, the mystics can find all of the most loving verses and point to those and say, "No, this is where the truth is."
Yeah.
How do we reconcile the fact that these religious texts are full of both, and how can we make sure that we're not, kind of cherry picking the ones that just happen to resonate with us or something? Oh,
Sure.
do we have a
So
balanced view of God?
that's a wonderful question and a real question, and obviously not one that can be answered in a few minutes. I think these are some of the beginning points of how I would suggest a path of moving through that. So to begin with, you're exactly right. Every one of our traditions contains statements in our foundational texts that can be used, has been used, is being used to justify and legitimate violence. And if you think they don't exist in your tradition, you're just not looking hard enough. And whether it's, of course, the Amalek language in the Old Testament, men, women, children, ox and donkeys being slaughtered, and we see the Israeli government using that against Palestinians and Iranians and Lebanese, whether it's the Old Testament language of smash your enemy's babies on rocks, right? I mean, these are horrific statements. We have versions of that in the Islamic tradition. Certainly, while the language of jihad is primarily a method of defending the community, we've also seen movements that use that in ways that are grotesque and violent. And even Jesus, peace be upon him, there are statements put in his mouth that he came not to bring peace, but the sword. And if we thought if there's one religious tradition that's immune to all of this, that it would be Buddhism, a religion founded on nonviolence. And of course, we've had Buddhist militias and Buddhists in Myanmar committing ethnic cleansing. So none of us have a perfectly immaculate record. I think the question that we want to ask is, if ever there was a time where there was a certain measure of nobility in warfare, where you actually had to line up against your opponent, you had to look the person whom you're engaging in hand-to-hand combat or cross your swords against one, that day is long gone. And now we're living in an age where, men of extraordinary power and greed, whose lives bear no fragrance of anything religious or spiritual, can issue an order and bombs fall on innocent lives, wiping away thousands. I mentioned that my own background is as an Iranian, even though by the grace of God, an accident of family history, I was born in the US. on the very first day of this American-Israeli war on Iran, the country that I'm a citizen of dropped a Tomahawk missile on a middle school for girls. And we wiped out 165 preteen girls. Now, fairly certain that Jesus and Moses and Muhammad would have never sanctioned something like this. This next thing that I'm going to say is challenging for some people, but in the last 2.5 years, there's been a minimum of 20,000 Palestinian children who've been bombed to death. The Jesus that I know, the Muhammad that I know, the Moses that I know, would be weeping at the death of any one of these children. So our goal, I don't think, is to sanitize the full spectrum of what our religious traditions historically have been, but to ask the question, whom would Jesus bomb? Whom would Muhammad starve? Whom would Moses ethnically cleanse? I think those are important and appropriate questions for us to ask. And our goal should never be to defend the full spectrum of the historicity of our religious languages. We come back to Matthew 25. That which you do to the least of God's children, you do unto me. And we have verbatim accounts of that same teaching from the prophet Muhammad, that God is, if you want to know where God is with the hungry, God is with the thirsty, God is with the sick, God is with the brokenhearted. I think those are the highest aspects of our teachings that we need to cling to and we need to resurrect and embody in our own day and age. And as for opportunistic politicians who have nothing but a history of greed and corruption and rape, why on earth or why on heaven would I ever trust them to tell me who Jesus is?
Amen. Amen. Thank you for that. Well, that was heavy, but I do want to take us into something a bit. I don't really have much to add. I appreciate what you're saying there, and I mean, I guess my heart just is going out to the victims of all of these atrocities.
All of us, and all of them.
Well, you gave us a little bit. So one of the kind of the through lines that we were hearing from our guests in the first season of the podcast was how sacred listening is. And that's actually what inspired us to kind of design this season around, well, how can we listen to other faith traditions? And so I wanted to ask you, and not just listen, but how do we listen without agenda, where we're truly just hearing? So I wanted to know, how do you cultivate a way of listening and listening without agenda in your life?
In Islam, God is said to have infinite names and qualities, and sometimes they're numbered as 100. And 100 was like one of the biggest numbers that they knew, right? And so one of those divine names, divine qualities, is As-Sami, which is the listening, the hearing. There's something quite divine about deep listening. The name Ishmael comes from that same root. And there is the question of what is the purpose of dialogue? Is it, here's an opportunity for me to convince and persuade the other person? Is it, here's an opportunity for me to learn about the other person, kind of spiritual curiosity. A little bit deeper, higher would be, what is it that I might be able to learn from this person, right? When I studied the Taoist tradition, it was an opportunity to learn something about the sanctity of living in harmony with nature. And I had not quite experienced that as deeply in my own tradition until I saw it in Taoism. And I would say that the highest level for me, at least, of listening is an opportunity to learn with someone. There is a friendship that is established. There is an agreement to set out on a shared path together. And there's a mutuality, a reciprocity, where I'm learning from you, and perhaps there might be something in the wisdom of my tradition that could make your own life more luminous. So that learning with, I think, is one of the gifts of a deep listening, and it can really only come through a practice of humility. That God is so grand, the ocean is so vast, that each one of us are really dipping our toes into a small sample of it. And there's much to learn from our friends, and we're better together in that light.
Since you mentioned the water once more, I have to bring up the modern version of Rumi's idea, which was presented by David Foster Wallace at a commencement speech that he gave in 2005 at Kenyon College. I had to pull this up because I want to make sure to get it right. But he starts his speech with this little joke about two young fish swimming along who meet an older fish. And the older fish nods and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two fish continue swimming for a bit, and eventually one looks over at the other and says, "What the hell is water?"
Right.
Yeah,
Exactly.
I think that's a perfect metaphor for, obviously what you're saying, but really what we're trying to do here. So this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for
I'm honored. I'm honored for this time. And thank you, Dave, and thank you, friends, for opening up this space and holding it for us to be able to share these conversations.
Absolutely. So if people want to find out what you're up to, Omid, where should they go?
Into their own hearts, alone with the one.
Well said, well said.
Find a wood or a beach or a mountaintop, a cave, where they can hear the still small mystery unfolding within themselves. And I think I can hear my business manager shaking her head, going like, "You're a terrible businessman, you know." It's I do sincerely hold to that, and I think God has never stopped speaking, and maybe that we get to hear. And if anything, in terms of what I've been able to share, has touched people's hearts, none of these are things that I've come up with. This is just the simple offerings of the Islamic tradition and through its Sufi mystical wisdom. And we have a website, illuminatedcourses.com. There's some online courses, there's some monthly gatherings. But probably the best of all, we have in-person retreats and journeys. That they can find the information on, and they're open to anybody, and come as you are. And we would be honored to hold space to share these conversations together.
Amazing. We'll be sure to link to your local cave. No, just kidding. Yeah, to your website in the show
Absolutely.
notes.
Absolutely.
But well taken. And yeah, I hope people do get out and enjoy the world God has made.
I mean.
Wow, what a beautiful soul and such a powerful and inspiring and wise person Omid is. That was one of those conversations where I just didn't really want it to end. I was very sad to see the hour pass so quickly. But we have a little bit more in store for you in terms of Islam. Next week, we talk to Gabriel Saeed Reynolds, who is a professor at Notre Dame and who teaches Islamic studies. And we'll hear all about what he learned from the Quran. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. As a marketer, I've never been content with just sources of entertainment, leaving it there and not getting into inviting someone into that next deeper thing, that experiential place. And so I think what better way to live our experienced reality than to do so together, crossing over boundaries of religion, which is what this season has obviously been all about. So if you resonate with your show, I invite you to take the next step and join our monthly interfaith gathering. You can sign up for it at the Religion to Reality Substack, which is at religiontoreality.substack.com. And it's easy to find. And you can sign up for it there. There's a post about the interfaith monthly gathering where you can register. Religion to Reality was created and executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.